Following is an oral history interview with Renato Ramirez by Mark Robbins for the South Texas Hispanic Farm Labor Community's Oral History Project. The interview took place on February 18th, 2013 in Corpus Christi, Texas. Renato Ramirez, now I'm forgetting the date. The date is...
Today?
Yeah.
Is the 18th? Hold on. Monday, 18th.
The 18th of February, 2013.
Yeah.
So I'll just put that there if you don't mind and just leave that there. So it's pretty open-ended. I'm really interested in hearing about your memories or even just stories you've heard about. It can be your family or neighbors and what it was like. As far back as you can remember, or even more recently in farm labor communities in Duval County, or even if that goes beyond there.
Well, I can cover quite a bit of ground,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah.
I was born in San Diego, Texas, back in 1953, on November 12th. My parents are from that area as well. My dad was born in Beeville, but eventually migrated to the San Diego area. And my mom was born in Los Reyes Ranch community back in 1923. My dad was born in 1914. Growing up in San Diego, some of my earliest memories were being picked up by this truck, a flatbed truck, that would come by right before sunup, honk the horn, and all my neighbors and my brothers and sisters and my mother would jump on the back of the truck, and we'd go off to the closest, to the cotton fields, and pick cotton. And that was my exposure to farming very early on. Then I learned that my uncles and aunts still lived on a farm. My mom was born on a ranch, and every time we had a holiday, the family, the extended family, would get together back at the ranch and hold a celebration, But I remember my mom telling me that when she was growing up at the ranch, there was no buses to take kids to school. So every now and then, my uncle was able to hire a teacher to live at the ranch. And she would teach all the children of the ranch community, in return for room and board. And, it allowed her to practice her profession as well, But that little ranching community was out in the middle of nowhere, and the men in the community built a church, had a one-room schoolhouse, and ranched and farmed, raised livestock and farmed crops for sustenance and hunted as well and so forth, I remember doing that. Growing up, let me see what else. That ranch is still in the hands of my family, my cousins, especially who is my age. She's got ownership of it. I haven't seen her for a while, but they still have the ranch, and it's still in the same place. And it's still a pretty desolate area,
Was it sort of a daily occurrence that the truck would come by?
That was daily, right, exactly. This was in the mid-50s, from the early 50s, roughly to about the mid-60s, we did that, After World War II, the men tried to get jobs in the economy. Those that could were lucky. Those that couldn't continued to try, whereas the wives and their kids would do menial labor, stoop labor. If you couldn't get a job as a maid or a gardener or something like that, you'd pick cotton, because it was always there. That work was always there, And I also wanted, well, my dad eventually, by the late 50s, roughly about 59, perhaps 1958, got a job at the Naval Air Station here in Corpus. And we could now stop picking cotton, okay, because he was bringing home a decent wage and a steady job with civil service benefits and such, you know, so that was great. And that was a big boon for us, you know. We bought our first car. We actually got an inside toilet, okay, wow, inside the house, you know, instead of having an outhouse like we used to. I remember that transition that took place, okay. But more than that, I remember my dad telling me as well that he used to hunt to gather food to eat. And he would also do farming, ranching, and hunting. He went to school formally to public schools only up to the third grade and dropped out in order to work. So whatever he could do to work, he did it roughly at about 10 years old. You know, actually third grade, you're 8, 9 years old, you know. Mm-hmm. So he gave up public education in order to go to work, hunt, and help his parents, you know, put food on the table and survive, things like that. My mother was able to graduate from high school, you know, so that was good. But my dad was basically self-taught. He learned how to read later on in his life after he had gotten jobs and so forth and picked up a Bible and stuff. But he was always sort of a... That's why he strived so hard to make sure that we went to school, you know, because it was something that he never got to do himself. But I remember him telling me that he used to hunt in the woods for food. He'd also pick medicines, you know, folk medicines, bark, leaves, different roots. He knew what to pick because his grandmother showed him which were medicinal and which were edible and so forth. And so he'd also go out and do that. His grandmother was generally considered to be sort of like a faith healer or a folk medicine doctor, you know, in these communities where people were at, that you had no access to a medical doctor here, mm-hmm. you know. She was also a midwife, and his mother also raised orphans, that people, when parents would pass away or could no longer afford their children, they'd put them up for adoption, whatever. My grandmother would take them in and help raise them, you know. So it was sort of like people helping each other to pull through, you know.
Yeah.
And this is during, even before the Great Depression, you know, when this was going on. It was in the teens and in the 20s when this was going on. I remember asking my dad, how did the Great Depression affect you all? And he said, well, it didn't affect us at all, you know. We were poor to begin with, so we knew how to survive under those conditions. It affected the people that had a lot to lose, you know. Hmm. And if anything, it probably benefited these small ranching communities where I was at, because I remember my dad, he went to work with Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s. I think they had a 17-year-old membership threshold, but you could lie your way into it. He went in at about 15 years old, and started traveling the country doing work projects out in the field, you know, and it gave him structure, and it eventually got him all the way to California, and eventually he joined the military from that, you know, and then came back to South Texas and started a family, got married and stuff. But that was during those periods of the 1930s as well, and before then. And I remember him telling me also that he's in the 20s, when he was still sort of like a teenager, he used to see crews of workers, you know, before the 1920s and right around that time period. This is when this area of South Texas was being settled after oil had been discovered and ranching had been become more prominent and railroads have been put in, mm-hmm. you know, towns started springing up and stuff, and people started buying plots of land and so forth. Work crews would be hired by ranchers who would ask them to come clear their land, and then instead of paying them, sometimes they'd kill them and bury them, you know, and you'd never see the crews again, and there'd be no investigation, you know, and there was a lot of stuff like that that went on right during the World War One period, as a matter of fact. After that plan, the San Diego and, you know, the Zimmerman note became known, there was so much paranoia about subversives here in this area that they allowed for a lot of abuse of human rights to take place. Mass deportations, murder, burial in mass graves, things of that sort, were things that were whispered but never documented. But yet people would realize that, wow, these people went out to do a job and they never came back. You know, many times people would be hired not knowing that there was never an intention to pay them, you know. Some of those events have actually been documented in some of these newer books that have been written by a new generation of Hispanics, Chicanos down here in Texas, who have become educated and bold enough to actually print this, you know, because back you couldn't do that. You know, it was unheard of for anyone to write something like that. It would be considered fiction, outrageous, you know. And now more and more evidence is coming out that some of these things actually did happen, you know. So I'm glad to see that some of this is being brought to light, you know.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I think it's especially in terms of the style of history you have, not just what questions you're asking, but these are the kinds of things that wouldn't be on the front page of the newspaper.
Right, exactly. Well, people that would bring up issues like this or land disputes and things of this sort many times are seen as bandits, according to traditional history. And so they were cast in a very negative light and demonized, you know. Yet today, you know, they were probably a fair accounting of it would be that they were standing up for their property, you know, which in turn was confiscated by those that considered themselves the good guys back then, you know, and confiscated and covered up legally through the paperwork and the deeds and the title offices and such, you know, eventually. But now that's coming out. And better documentation, more accurate history has been written about this region, you know.
You mentioned your father being able to recognize different plants that were used for medicinal purposes.
Right, right.
Just out of curiosity.
I remember being cured of illness, basically a fright. Mm-hmm. I used to have nightmares growing up. I was a very sickly kid. And my mother had this woman come in and pray over me and use a broom to sweep the evil spirits out of me and then suck them out with a raw egg under my bed and have me drink tea made out of plants that were brought out of the forest, you know. So this was a commonly known medicines for ailments, different types, and not just physical ailments, but spiritual, emotional, things of that sort as well.
Did he, since he was very good at finding what plants and had been taught what they were from his parents and grandparents, did he supply some of these plants for other people in the community or act as a healer himself?
Well, my grandmother would use them to heal others that neighbors and so forth, you know, because a lot of times neighbors were far and few between, you know. And so if you lived in a small ranching community, everyone knew that your grandmother could help you, you know. Mm-hmm. And my father was probably not the only guy doing that. Guys his age were probably raised with the same knowledge, mm-hmm. you know, that this is good for this is good for that, you know, how to treat poisonous bites, how to treat, you know, earaches, toothaches, mm-hmm. Pregnancy, hangover, anything, you know. Oh, they actually yeah. knew. I remember having a flame blown into my ear, you know. They'd make a paper cone, and they'd light a match at the end of it, and then blow the flame into your ear, and it would automatically melt all the wax that had built up in your ear, and it would drain out, and hopefully it would drain off the infection as well, you know. Some of it makes sense,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, and for a hangover, too, that's interesting. That's, I was like, well, maybe I ought to try that one of these days. You mentioned before churches. To what extent did you see? When was the first church you can remember? Was that a major focal point of a community there?
Oh yeah, the small town where I grew up, San Diego, is the oldest Roman Catholic diocese south of San Antonio, and it was formed back in the 1860s, I think. Okay, the church is a beautiful church. It's got sort of a cross between Romanesque and Gothic architecture, and in front of the church is the town square, the plaza, okay? And the plaza has a gazebo right in the center, and it's got a radial pattern of sidewalks that come out, and it's four square blocks in length, something like that, and it sits right at the entrance of the church. So it's the town center, you know? In that small town, I'd venture to say 99% of the population were Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. And many of them were related to each other, you know, because of intermarriage over the years, you know. By the time I was 6 years old, 5 years old, I was an altar boy, you know. And this is before this is when Catholics were required to know the Mass in Latin, okay? That didn't change until the mid-60s. 63, I think, was the year that the Catholic Church in Rome finally said that you can give the Mass in the native language, okay? Spanish, English, Filipino, whatever, okay? So prior to that, you had to know the Mass in Latin and all the refrains and responses and so forth. So I knew that very young. I remember doing a midnight mass when I was about 6 years old. And I went to Catholic school as a young boy until it ran out of money, and then we all ended up going to the public schools. But we continued to go to Catholic education, parochial schools. After the day in the public school, you'd go to Catholic school, religious catechism, okay? Mm-hmm. Every day until I graduated from the 12th grade. I actually received a diploma from the church as well, you know, so it was a major impact in our lives. My dad was the same way. My mom was the same way. We were all very close to the church, mm-hmm. you know. And my sister is still very, very close. I've sort of drifted now in these years, but while I may not be very active with the church, I'm still very deeply religious mm-hmm. as far as the idea of faith and stuff like that, you know. Partly out of fear.
Well, you know,
it makes good sense. But,
Just out of curiosity, or actually more than out of curiosity, one thing that I'm really interested in is in terms of the geography of community.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned the church there, and when it came to working life, and the, in particular picking cotton, how far from the San Diego area would that work be?
Actually, outside of San Diego, on the way on Highway 44, coming toward Corpus Christi, about right before you get to the town of Alice, there's a small community called Springfield. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I distinctly remember at the corner of Highway 44 and Springfield Road, there was a large, large section of cotton fields. That's where we would pick, okay? And but, I mean, South Texas is filled mm-hmm. with cotton fields, okay? My uncle, at his ranch at Los Reyes, used to grow corn, used to grow watermelons, used to grow squash, beans, and cotton as well, okay? So I had a little bit of experience picking corn mm-hmm. and picking watermelons as well, so forth. In the summers, whenever the crop was in and he needed help, all the cousins would go out there and get friends, and we'd do that. I've cut sugarcane with a what do you call it, a scythe?
Machete or
no? Actually, like a Russian scythe.
Oh man, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Hammer and sickle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
the sickle, you know, the Mexican sickle is not as big and wide. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's called a yo-yo. Okay. It's a long wooden handle with a sort of like a bow, half semicircle of metal, which holds a blade that is sharp on both edges, okay? And what you do, you swing it back and forth, and just everything in your way gets cut down. You just have to be careful not to put your leg in the way, you know? But that we use that for sugar cane, which was a product that was raised in some of the ranches as well, you know? And the closest sugar mill is probably in Houston, Sugarland, okay? Imperial Sugar has their original factory there, okay? And that was there for years and years and years. So that is sometimes sort of like a backup crop to mm-hmm. to cotton and other standard staples, you know, that mm-hmm. are grown in this area. But, we would go just around the surrounding community. There's always mm-hmm. ranches around that need pickers, you know. Agua Dulce, Springfield, the Alice area, Banquete, mm-hmm. you know, places like that. Because coming toward the coast, the land is a lot flatter, mm-hmm. and you can. It's made for growing cotton specifically, you know, but also sorghum and other types of grain, okay? Mm-hmm. As you go further west, and especially, say, past San Diego, you start getting into the hilly, brushy, mm-hmm. non-arable type of land. It takes mm-hmm. too much money. It's better for ranching, for livestock raising, you know? So it was always toward the coast that you'd go to pick, you know? And we would pick from sunup to sundown, you know. I was real young at the time, and so I used a child's bag, which was probably weighed maybe 10 pounds at the most when filled, whereas adults would use bags that would stretch about 6, 7, 8 feet, and you could fill it up with cotton. It'll take you hours to fill it up. And then once you filled it up, take it to the truck, they'd weigh it, mm-hmm. and write down how much you picked, and then you'd head back out to the field. And then at the end of the day, they would pay you based on how much you brought in, you know. And I think it might have been a nickel a bag or something like that, you know. It was bad, man, but it kept us working anyway.
Did they have much supervision in terms of when
the same people that drove the truck, my uncle used to drive the truck, he would pick too, you know, so everybody was involved in picking. Young kids, they would try and keep you out of the direct sun during the hottest part of the day, so you'd pick in the morning and then toward the evening, you know, and during the hottest part of the day they'd probably sit you under the truck just to rest, you know. Mm-hmm. But the older folks, the more sturdier, healthier folks, they had broad hats and long sleeve shirts and to cover not just from the sun, but also from the plants themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. Some fields were a combination of corn, cotton, and other types of grain. And so you were always rubbing up against them, and it would cut right through you, you know. if you weren't wearing the proper clothes. And there was also the danger of snakes and stuff like that as well.
Did you ever see a lot of snakes?
And well, I remember we used to
bite anybody or?
Well, no, you know, I remember telling Derek Oden, you know, what they do down here. If you ever see a snake laying across a fence, that's done to generate rain. Okay, if you can kill a rattlesnake, especially a rattlesnake, you don't want to kill the non-poisonous snakes. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are good. Okay, they get rid of rodents, and they actually kill rattlesnakes, like the black indigo. Mm-hmm. Okay, the black indigo snakes are constrictors, and they kill rattlesnakes. They'll actually hunt them down and kill them, you know. So you want to see those around. It's just scary when you see them because they're so big, you know. But a rattlesnake, I remember we used to kill them. They chopped their head off, and they'd lay it across the top strand of a fence, a barbed wire fence, and that's supposed to generate rain, okay? And so that's sort of like an old myth or a legend or whatever, but it's a practice that is still done, you know. And so we did that all the time. You'd always see that, you know. If you'd see a snake, you'd call the man, the older man, and they'd come by, and they'd either have a machete or maybe a rifle in the cab of the truck or something, you know. But they were able to kill those pretty much. I remember in high school, when I was in high school, in the late 60s, early 70s, the Raza Unida movement here in South Texas was organized, okay? As a matter of fact, at A&I Kingsville is where it was organized. And the founders of the Raza Unida party was José Ángel Gutiérrez and Carlos Guerra and Efraín Hernández. They were all students at Kingsville. And they organized boycotts and walkouts and sit-ins, especially over the treatment of farm laborers, okay? And they were able to bring César Chávez down to the valley and organize the United Farm Workers. And I have newspaper articles showing meetings that were held and Chávez addressing the crowd and the Catholic Church also in support of that, you know. So that eventually became a source of political strife and differences between the state. You know, they didn't want to provide any type of medical coverage, no minimum wages, no recognition of labor rights for stoop laborers, you know, cotton pickers and others, onion pickers and so forth in the valley. And so they organized, got Chávez to bring attention, national attention, to the issue of farm laborers down here in the valley and organize the farm workers, you know. But not only that, it also called attention to police brutality against people who were arrested and spoke very little English. Many times you had grand juries that were all white. You had sheriffs that were all white. You had Texas Rangers conducting investigations that didn't have their heart in it. And you'd have people that would be arrested on a minor infraction, and all of a sudden, the next day, they'd be found dead in their cells, you know. Hanging from a belt or beaten to death and things of this sort. When people would call for an investigation, the police were always cleared, you know. And so people started bringing, you know, conducting marches, public marches, demanding that the government, the federal government, open up civil rights investigations and things of this sort, you know. And so they eventually forced much more open and honest government.
Do you have recollections of participating and or seeing the civil rights activism while you were at A&I?
Well, actually, in Alice...
Or in Alice, yeah.
Yeah. There was a march held by the Raza Unida Party and the Brown Berets. Alice, this is shortly after the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 65. I participated in the march on my bicycle. Okay, we marched downtown and congregated in front of the police station. And it was covered by the newspaper, the Corpus Christi Caller Times. They sent their head photographer, George Gongora, and I remember him taking photos from the back of a pickup truck of the marchers who were throwing rocks to the police and to businesses and so forth, you know. And he got pelted by rocks himself. And I remember asking him, do you remember this and that? And he said, yeah, I was there. And I said, yes, I know. We were there throwing rocks at you, you know. But that was a march that probably had about 300 people involved. And it was, you know, it originally was a candidates forum out in the public plaza where candidates would give their spiel on running for office. But eventually the Brown Berets, which were known for radicalizing events like this, you know, got people motivated and agitated to march, you know, and we did that downtown. We also had a couple of walkouts from our high school that were investigated by the police, you know. I helped organize, me and a couple of guys, and we wrote some newsletters urging students to walk out of school on a certain day. And when it happened, you know, it brought the class day to a standstill, you know. And the police were called in, and people were expelled and such. But it eventually forced the school board and the school administration to listen to the complaints of students, you know. So that was very helpful. But there were many other marches that took place, and especially down in the valley, because by the time 1971 and 2 came around, well, I graduated in 72. By the time 73 came around, I was down in the valley, and I witnessed some of those events more.
What were your memorable impressions of those marches?
Oh, I loved them. You know, for a young kid, relatively young, I was 18 years old. You know, it was exciting to be involved in something political and historical, you know. Like I said, this is shortly after the passage of the Civil Rights Law and the Voting Rights Law. All of a sudden, there was a lot of energy within the Hispanic community that, you know, now we can have a say-so. And we can take part in decisions that affect us, you know. And so you had Hispanics running for mayor and school board and police chief in towns that has historically been, they had been excluded from, even though they made up 70% of the population, you know. So it was very, very motivating and very great to be involved in that type of situation where that happened. And my brother, who was older than me, knew the people that organized a lot of these marches and organized that political party, who actually had gubernatorial candidates running for office, you know. They were personal friends of each other. So that was great, you know. Really enjoyed that, too. My father hated it. My father was a World War II veteran, and he didn't like the idea of people taking up arms and, you know, protesting the government, because he fought for the government, you know, and he saw them as troublemakers and as long-haired troublemakers and potheads and so forth, you know. Get a job, you know, go to work like I did, you know. He struggled. He never graduated. He was put into the workforce almost immediately, missed his childhood and so forth. And he felt that anyone that, you know, you're living at home, and while I'm out at work, you're doing this, you know, it's shameful, don't do it. Get a job, get a responsibility, things of this sort. It was a different generational clash, you know, but somebody had to do it to bring attention to it. Right. And this was the first generation of Hispanics that had access to college on a large scale. even though there were colleges down here, regional colleges, still, for the first time ever, they were getting an education on the Constitution and the laws, and how come this doesn't apply to us, you know, and all this type of stuff. So they, it was important, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of intergenerational conflicts between families over the way it was being done. Here in Corpus Christi, the old generation was represented by LULAC and Dr. Hector Garcia. They didn't like the Raza Unida. The Raza Unida were the long-haired, young, hothead college students, whereas the older generation of LULAC were people that were dressed in suits, had professional jobs, and they wanted to work with the lawmakers. You know, they didn't want to work against them. Whereas the younger generation were all about direct action. You know, being out in the streets, protesting, boycotts, strikes, whatever. You know, using the non-traditional methods, whereas the older folks wanted to work within the system, you know. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing that happened with the Black Civil Rights Movement as well, you know. But it was more of a microcosm down here in South Texas. And we had our own issues to bring up, you know. And a lot of, I mean, but they all had to do with the idea of inequality. Mm-hmm. Lack of jobs, lack of access, lack of determination, man, you know. Mm-hmm. So all that, every generation finds their own way of expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the differences then, you know. And it was part of the 60s generation. That was it. More confrontational than it was back in the 40s and 50s, you know.
Did you ever find or hear of from your father or from others moments where folks back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, or even the 50s, you know, asked for higher wages or anything like that?
My dad actually got fired from the Department of the Army because there was an inspector general that came to the military base, a RADMAC, okay, here in Corpus Christi. And right before he left, he inspects the entire base, okay? And this was the biggest helicopter depot during the Vietnam War, and still is the biggest helicopter depot of any base in the country. Before he left, they had the entire civilian workforce and the uniformed workforce in formation. And the Inspector General of the Army asked, "Does anyone have any questions of me?" And my dad had the guts to stand forward and pose the general the question. And he said, "Look, there are a lot of Hispanic men here that served in World War II valiantly in the Korean War, and yet all they do is get jobs in custodial services or housekeeping. They can't get any promotions, yet they are trained and they're technically proficient and they're hard workers, you know. Would you please see why we can't get promoted?" And the general took that down and he said, "I'll look into it. Thank you." And then he left. And they called my dad to the front office for speaking out and fired him that day. And that same day, the Navy, which is also in the base, hired him, you know. That's the way it was. You weren't supposed to speak out. My dad eventually died of poisoning through Agent Orange, PCBs, dioxins, all types of solvents that he was exposed to while at work at the base for 29 years, okay? He developed lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, primarily based on skin cancer, melanoma, and other types, okay? Right now there's a class action lawsuit that's going forward by people that are finally getting recognition for being exposed to those dangers back in the 60s, you know? But my dad, he didn't last long enough, okay? But there were a lot of people that complained like that. My dad wasn't the only one. Many people. But a lot of times, the best way to stop the complaints was to fire the folks and hire someone who's not going to complain and is willing to work for a cheaper wage, you know?
Did he recall or others recall, or do you recall seeing similar things happening and when picking cotton?
Well,
was there any kind of negotiation back in the compensation or treatment
back there? In the 40s, my dad, in 1947, the same year that the American GI Forum was organized here in Corpus Christi, 48, They organized the Freedom Party in Duval County to counter George Parr, who was a political boss of those counties right there, okay? Jim Wells, Brooks County, Duval County, part of Webb County, okay? He was the biggest landowner, had the most money, and he controlled San Diego by making sure that he controlled every single political office. He controlled the public schools, the school board, superintendent, chief of police, county sheriff, tax collector and assessor, county judges, you name it. And he didn't like workers working outside of the county, okay? When these people came back from the war, they still saw the way things were, and they had no political voice. They organized and ran their own candidates against George Parr's men. And Parr was actually accused of murder. One of the candidates that they ran for office. Actually, they had an attorney that defended the Freedom Party. The Freedom Party got in touch with the Justice Department and the Texas Rangers and had them investigate Parr for the destruction of public records. Okay, Parr burned down the courthouse twice to prevent records from being found that implicated him with voter fraud. Box 13, for example, in Duval County. You know, my dad was jailed on with no charges filed against him solely because he was a troublemaker. Okay, they hired an attorney named Jake Floyd from Alice, Texas. His son was killed by mistake instead of him by a hitman that had been hired by George Parr. Okay, and that's been documented as well. In recent years and such. So there was a lot of political intrigue that was going on. They tried to end Parr's reign, control over Duval County for decades, and it wasn't until 1975 that the guy committed suicide. That's when it ended, you know. But before that, he controlled everything that was going on. And so you had Parr's people, and then you had those that were anti-Parr. You always had these two factions in Duval County and Jim Wells County and Brooks County and places like that, Premont, Fafurias, San Diego, that were, you had to watch who you hung out with and what you said publicly, because if you said it too loud and someone from the Parr side heard you and news got to him, your dad all of a sudden would be fired. Or your mom would be fired, or things of this sort. You know, they could put a lot of pressure on people to move out of the city, fire you, trump up charges against you, have you arrested, things of this sort. I remember seeing a cockfight broken up by Parr's men who actually showed up with machine guns because the guys that were there were anti-Parr members of the Freedom Party. This is a probably about 1955 when it happened, you know. But I was about 3 or 4 years old at the time, you know, 56, 57 when it happened. But it was real close to my house, you know. It was a common event where men would get together on a Friday after they got paid, and the women would cook food inside, and the men would hang out in the garage, and sometimes they'd have roosters, and they'd be fighting each other, and money would go down, and Parr didn't like that. Boom, he'd come in and have them break it up, you know, at gunpoint, you know. I remember seeing that as a boy, you know, so that was pretty exciting.
Was it, were they the police? Or
it was the county sheriff, the sheriff and their deputies, but they were controlled by Parr, you know. And it was such a small town that you couldn't help but know the families of the good and bad people, you know. Even though Parr controlled the county sheriff, I knew his son. He lived down the street from me, and we hung out together, you know. And yet when my dad would find out that I was hanging out with the county sheriff's son, he'd punish me. Don't you ever go over there. And you know, I remember going to Parr's swimming pool, because it was the only swimming pool in the city. And people would flock over there, knock on the door, and ask his maid, can we use the pool? And, you know, PAR would allow kids to use the pool, regardless of who your parents were. Mm-hmm. But when your parents would find out you were at PAR's house, bah! You know, the back of the hand, you know. Don't do that. Don't go over there, you know. He's my sworn enemy. You know, people were that divided over the guy. He was a savior to a lot of folks, but at the same time, he was a bane to others, you know.
Yeah.
Real bad.
Did he have any, do you remember any relationship between the PAR family and any of the major employers around there in terms of, like, who owned the PAR, cotton fields or who owned the...
Yeah. Robert Driscoll, Driscoll Hospital.
Yeah.
Was one of the main ranchers in Duval County, okay? PAR had a big ranch as well in Duval County. His brother had another ranch over here in Benavides, which goes into Brooks and Jim Wells County as well, you know, part of it. All those ranches had oil drilling in it, okay? Exxon, Mobil, Texaco, all these companies would, and then you had the drilling companies themselves go drill the wells. Then you had the oil companies set up pumps and storage facilities. So they were all involved together, you know. There was also cattle raising. They raised cattle. They had horse racing as well, okay. San Diego was generally known, sort of like the Wild West of the area. There was prostitution that was legal. There was gambling that was legal, or at least it was not enforced, these laws. And so it was seen sort of like Sin City of South Texas, you know. A lot of smuggling that was going on during... I remember my dad would tell me that they helped smuggle bootleg liquor during Prohibition in the 1920s. They would go from the border to San Diego to San Antonio, you know, and they'd help transport or change over transportation from one vehicle to another down in those areas. And I'm pretty sure that the PAR family benefited from that as well, you know. Hmm. So a lot of that happened back in those times, you know. And I have uncles and brothers, and not brothers, but uncles and relatives that lived through it that can give you much more detail than I could, you know.
Well, that's really interesting.
My father's remaining brother still lives today. He's 92 years old. He's in Hobbs, New Mexico, but he grew up down here. And I grew up picking cotton with his sons and daughters and such. You know, we were all together in it, you know.
Did you find when you were picking cotton, was it normally the same people on the fields all the time?
Yeah, a lot of my cousins.
Were there migrant workers that came through too, or just...
No, it was the community, San Diego. You know, the entire town would go to a certain field, you know. And I'm sure that in Benavides they had a person there that owned a truck that could take families out to go pick. So, you know, my cousins, my sisters and brothers, and my friends were the ones that I was picking cotton with, you know, that I eventually went to school with, you know, as well. So it wasn't, we all knew each other. And for the most part, we're all related, you know, because I had my brother, my father had a large family, his brothers had a large family, his other brother had a large family, his sister had a large family, and they all had extended families, and they'd all pitch in together and go pick, you know. So that was good. Most of them were illiterate as far as formal education was concerned, you know. That wasn't for them. They worked, you know. Going to school doesn't bring money into the house, you know. And if anything, it costs money, you know. So that was the attitude that a lot of them had back then. I hope that helps.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. If you can think of any other specific questions you want to ask, that's fine.
Sure. Well, maybe if it works for you, I'll take this, and then if you wouldn't mind, maybe I'll get a chance to talk to Christine and yeah. see if she has other questions.
I have some, like I said, those newspapers that I have yeah. at home that deal with the walkouts and sit-ins and
yeah.
Raza Unida. Those are first-hand documents, one of a kind. If you want to take a look at them.
Sure, I would love to, or I could take pictures of them.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But I guess I'll stop this right here while chatting here.